Shall we start? All the soul's postures donned divinity. It's a very interesting image. When he says soul's postures, the positions that your inner being takes towards the experiences of life. Your inmost being takes its relationship with the experiences of life. The first one he uses is love. Love, he describes as love that takes, love that gives. There met the ardent mutual intimacies of mastery's joy and the joy of servitude. The joy of mastery, the ruler, there's a power, love has power, love controls. Or the joy of being a servant, the joy of serving. That is no greater joy than serving the divine, for instance. So of mastery's joy and the joy of servitude, imposed by love on love's heart that obeys. Love that rules, love that obeys. It is not a question of being superior or being inferior. The one who is ruling is love. The one who is ruled is also has the joy of being ruled, or being a slave of the divine. That's one of the lines, as Mother says later, that describes an experience that is the most powerful experience she had in this story of Savitri. Forever love, O beautiful slave of God. She is the beautiful slave of God. That is, she says it gave her the strongest experience of the poem. What is her role in the world? Simply to love. Simply to be a slave. For man's notion of love is to possess, to dominate, to control. There is such an immense joy of losing oneself completely in the experience of self-giving. There is no greater joy than that. So this is imposed by love on love's heart that obeys, even on the vital plane. Of course, Mother's experience was not just on the vital plane, it was a complete experience. But all the same, imposed by love on love's heart that obeys, and love's body held beneath a rapturous yoke. Heart and body. The very experience which is simply the control of love over the ego. So he gets the image of the yoke. The yoke, which is the symbol of servitude. You put a yoke on a bullock, the bullock loses its freedom. Man, in his ordinary thinking, says, I'm free to love, I'm free to be. That kind of man is a slave. He's a slave of his ego. He is never free. The man who can offer himself totally and does not demand his satisfaction of the ego, that man is truly free, because he has lost himself in the experience of surrender. He doesn't belong to himself any longer. So, and love's body held beneath a rapturous yoke. All was a game of meeting kinglinesses. Everything was an experience of supreme, you might say, splendor, kingliness, in the sense the king is above the rest. The king represents the ideal of the race. That was in the ancient world, the notion of kings. A king was not necessarily just the son of a king. A king was one who could lead and guide the race to a higher and nobler way of life. That was the purpose of the true king. So here, these are the kinglinesses. If we can learn to offer ourselves completely, we become supreme, part of the supreme. For worship lifts the worshipper's bowed strength, close to the god's pride and bliss his soul adores. If you worship, if you offer yourself, if you surrender, your surrender takes you close to the divine to whom you have surrendered yourself. You are part of him. It doesn't actually make you small, it makes you vaster. So the bowed strength is the sense of you doing pranam, you're bowing down in front of a greater divinity. That greater divinity is what fills your being. When he says here pride, it seems the greatness. It's not a greater ego, even the vital pride. Sometimes he uses the word proud. Proud is splendid. Proud is what is noble and grand. Nature of the Kshatriya. The ruler there is one with all he rules. That is the great king. That was actually the purpose of kings in the ancient days. In all communities, in all societies, the king is the ruler because he is aware of the needs of all his people. So all his people, with all their difficulties, all their problems, are guided by this ruler who is aware of their problems. He takes on himself the difficulties. This is what the divine has done. This is what Mother and Sri Aurobindo have done. They have come down on earth. They have taken on themselves our difficulties. Otherwise, how can they show us the way out of our problems? The burden of pain is not something that they have taught us to escape from. They are going through it themselves so that we learn to grow through each experience. So that is the greatness of the ruler. He is one with all he rules. The love, the compassion, the acceptance. I don't have to deserve the divine by becoming great. I'm small. The divine will take me up in my smallness. He understands my difficulty. He will lift me up from where I am to the next level where I can reach. There is no judgment. There is no rejection. In a certain mental attitude, you may say you are not worthy. You don't deserve. Certainly none of us deserve the divine. We have not worked on our natures to perfect it before we can approach the divine. The divine approaches us. He takes us up. He will show us the way because we cannot on our own work our way towards him by ourselves. So this is the whole approach of surrender, of self-giving, of devotion, of obedience. The ruler there is one with all he rules. To him, now this is a very beautiful law he's teaching us. To him who serves with a free, equal heart, obedience is his princely training school. To obey, if you are very proud of yourself, if you consider yourself as an important person, you feel, why should I obey? I should command. The greater you are, the greater your capacity to obey the divine. You bow down before the divine. It trains you towards complete identification with his will. I will do what you will. I have no personal will. I have no personal you might say, programs that I want to follow. I want to be like this, I want to be like this. I will be whatever you ask me to be. So to obey the Divine makes me closer to Him. This is something we don't realize, the power of surrender, of obedience, of devotion, which takes away from us this notion which is nowadays so rampant. You have to be responsible for yourself. I'm not responsible for myself. I don't even know who I am. I give myself to you, you say to the Divine, and you say, you take charge. You take me along the path that you decide I should follow. Who am I to decide? The modern notion of freedoms, I will decide what I want to do, I will go where I want to go, I will worship, I will admire, I will obey that call that will lead me forward, which I think will lead me forward. How much do I know? Instead, I say I don't know anything. I am nothing. I am in your hands. Do with me what thou willst, for I am yours. That demands a greater courage and a greater strength. To be able to say to the Divine, do with me what thou wilt, for I am thine. I have offered my whole ego, my whole existence to the Divine. That is why obedience is His princely training school, His nobility's coronet and privilege. You know, there were different levels of nobilities. The highest in the land was the king, who wore a crown. Below the king were the dukes, who wore coronets, lesser crowns. And there was a constant, in the feudal age, a series of descending noblemen, from the dukes to the counts, the earls, the marquesses, I don't know the exact order, coming down to the knights and the lords. But they all had a claim to greatness, to power. As you came down the slope of the hierarchy, your claim was less. As you reached the highest peak, you control the whole kingdom. Because you control the kingdom, you are the supreme. Because you are the supreme, you are the embodiment of the supreme, the divine's representative. That is when the king realized, I am the representative of the divine. I am not me. Through me, he will do his work. If we can keep that in mind, the person who is ruling a country, he has to be constantly aware that somebody else is ruling through him, is commanding through him. He has to be receptive, he has to be open to that somebody else, the Divine. If I have that faith, then these are all conditions which require one absolute precondition, abolition of the ego. His faith is a high nature's idiom. Faith, when I offer myself to another, to the Divine, to the Supreme, that indicates the greatness. Not to rely on myself, I rely on you. Whatever you say, whatever you want, as Mother kept on saying towards the end of her physical existence, what thou wilt, Lord, what thou wilt. Let thy will be done, not mine. The Supreme Mother says this, your will has to work through me, not my idea of what is good, not my idea of what is the supreme realization. So his nobility's coronet and privilege, his faith is a high nature's idiom. Idiom is an expression. You know, you have a phrase, a very, you might say, colloquial phrase is an idiom. His service, a spiritual sovereignty. To be able to be the servant of the Lord, that is the greatest ruler. There were realms where knowledge joined creative power. In her high home made her all his own. In her high home, in the home of power, he made knowledge, power and knowledge, consciousness and force. So on this level of the consciousness, which is here usually the sense of that which is the supreme wisdom, creative power, the chit goes hand in hand with Shakti. Page 125. There were high realms where knowledge joined creative power. So we have so many images where the Lord is, you might say, uniting with the power of evolution, the power of manifestation. It is the Mother Shakti, the slow emergence of consciousness through manifestation. So the two have to go together. It is not enough for us to have knowledge. We have access to knowledge. We are reading Sri Aurobindo. To some extent, something must be, you think, absorbed by our being. But to be able to put it into execution, into expression, the being has to participate. It's not enough to read. You have to be. So that being takes charge of our physical, our vital life. Then we live what we are reading. Then it becomes more worthwhile. That is the grand illuminate. The illuminate is the wise one. Knowledge seized her gleaming limbs, the limbs of the divine power, the Shakti, the Devi Shakti, the two aspects, the Lord and the Shakti, and filled them with the passion of his ray, till all her body was its transparent house, and all her soul a counterpart of his soul. You see, these are all lines that are describing the glory of life. He's not talking of the highest levels of consciousness. But even on the levels of the life, vital plane, these are cosmic powers. These are where the gods are, the vital gods, the gods of manifestation, the gods of existence, the gods of change, the gods of, you see, mastery. Those are all vital manifestations. And they have to be constantly manifested through nature. Nature on the lowest level, we have to, our physical nature, our vital nature has to be molded, altered, changed. Nature in the sense of not the lower nature only, the power that of change, of growth, of manifestation, of evolution, all these are taken up by that power of knowledge. To know is good, as she says. To live is better. To be, that is perfect. It's not enough to know, not enough to live only, to become, to embody, that is perfection. So that all her soul, a counterpart of his soul. And this we see it constantly on the highest level in, you might say, you can't call it a relationship, but what was really the way Mother worked out Sri Aurobindo's vision. It is not Sri Aurobindo's vision, it is also hers. They were not different. One did the work, one executed, and the other willed. He willed, she worked out. So it is this life. Everything has to be lived in the world of life. It is not enough to know. What is important is to be. Apotheosized, transfigured by wisdom's touch, her days became a luminous sacrifice. When say apotheosized, made absolutely raised to its highest level. You reach the highest level of perfection. Transfigured, that is again not exactly the same as transformation. Transfiguration is to raise from the lesser to the greater. So our daily life can be raised from its often lowest, very ordinary, dull, sometimes dirty state of consciousness in which we are. We can rise if we get really the touch of this consciousness. And we are here specially blessed because it is all around us. It is there. We can raise ourselves to a higher level. Then we live as an expression. Our life becomes an expression of their will, the will of the Mother and Sri Aurobindo, if you like. Her days became a luminous sacrifice, an immortal moth in happy and endless fire. The moth is drawn to the fire, but it does not burn up here. It is constantly drawn to the light, and that is the joy. You allow yourself to be completely obliterated. I am wiped off. I don't exist as an individual, separate identity. I am this fire. I am part of this, a spark of that fire. Even if I am a little spark of that flame, that is enough. I am taken up by this light. An immortal moth. This moth will never die. This spark is the eternal. It is in each of us, which is endlessly happy because it is illumined by the divine flame. An immortal moth in happy and endless fire. A captive life wedded her conqueror. Not the life that we consider the life of the vital satisfaction. The life...
One line, Guruji.
Huh?
You missed one line. She burned in a sweet, intolerable blaze.
Yes. Oh, sorry, I missed that. She burnt... But she's an immortal moth. So she's gone, that world of life is completely surrendered to that blaze, to that fire. There is a kind of infinite joy in self-giving. Sri Aurobindo mentioned that there's a small poem in English. It is by Shelley. And Sri Aurobindo says it is perhaps the only psychic poem in English. They don't have too many psychic poems. In which there's this line, the desire of the moth for the star, of the night for the morrow, the devotion to something afar, on the sphere of our sorrow. This is love. It's a beautiful short poem. It starts by what we call love is not love. One word is too often profaned. Profane is badly used. One word is too often profaned for me to profane it. I will not use that word. One feeling too falsely disdained for thee to disdain it. So, it is not love and not even pity. It is just the desire of the moth for the star, the lesser for the greater, constantly asking for that which is on the heights. From our sphere, which is a world of sorrow, a world of imperfection, to call for that light that is far above, to constantly surrender to that light, that is the highest aspect of human love. of self-giving completely without any conditions, any demands. She burnt in his sweet, intolerable blaze, the blaze of that fire of love, of divine love, and she burnt happily. It is as if living constantly, when all our littlenesses, all our imperfections are gradually being purified, eliminated, a captive life wedded her conqueror. And this is the ultimate joy, to be completely taken over by that supreme power. He has taken me up. He has taken me in his arms. I don't exist as an individual anymore. In his wide sky, she built her world anew. This world of life builds a new, wider, vaster universe. Our life otherwise is centered on our little selves. We are the center of our lives. It's a very small sky. It's a very small circle. To make ourselves part of a vaster universal principle of love, which is the capacity to surrender, to become part of that universal principle that is holding up the universe. In his wide sky, she built her world anew. She gave to mind's calm pace the motor speed. Usually the mind tries to be quiet. The mind also has to have energy. Life is energy. So we have to have a strong mind which gives energy to our thoughts, to our actions, put into practice what we think we should be. Otherwise, the mind likes to be in its own abstract world. But put into execution what we are dreaming of, that is another matter. To thinking, a need to live, what the soul saw, that is the difference. We realize what we have to be. Thinking tells me this is what I should be, this is what I should do, this is what is right. That is just the very first step. I have to live it. Be what I think I should be. Experience, embody, incarnate the truth. Otherwise, they are all empty words. To thinking, a need to live what the soul saw, to living, an impetus to know and see. Both ways. Living, but I have to be conscious. I have to know. I don't live blindly. The vital is blind and the mind doesn't have energy. To be able to blend in the mind the strength of the vital force, in the life the clarity of the mental vision. To have awareness. I have an ideal, I live that ideal. Otherwise we divide ourselves into different parts. The mind knows what is ideal, perhaps its own ideals at least. Life says, all this is fine, but I can't do it because my nature is weak. I have too many passions and too many desires, too many pulls in different directions. Life has to have that energy, but it has to be guided by that part which is an awareness of what is light, what is truth, what is perfection. That ideal has to be the guide. So it is like we read about the different gunas, if you like. So it is as if the satya guna controls the rajas. That has to be a rajasic push, but that has to be a sattvic element at the same time. Then it becomes a much more complete manifestation. An impetus to know and see, that is the consciousness. That is clarity, that is knowledge. That push has to be there in the world of life. His splendor, the splendor of the world of life, which is powerful, which is multiple, in all multifaceted, it is splendid. His splendor grasped her. Her presence to him clung. So the his splendor is the splendor of knowledge. Knowledge grasped life. Life's presence clung to knowledge. It's a kind of a marriage between knowledge and power, consciousness and force. She crowned the idea, a king in purple robes. That is the idea, that is the ideal, that is from where you get the word ideal. A king in purple robes is the ruling power, the supreme authority. We have to have a vision of the highest authority. At least we know that that highest ideal is what we have to live by. It will be our guide. So life helps us to raise ourselves, to be able to embody the ideal. You need an energy. Otherwise we put ourselves in different compartments. My mind knows what I should be. My vital says I can't do it. Because my vital has to collaborate. It has to give the energy to my conscious mind and say, you have to live this. You have to become this. You have to become what you believe you are. She crowned the idea, a king in purple robes, like a supreme emperor. Put her magic serpent scepter in thought's grip. The scepter is the rod of authority, the rod of change. The magic scepter, with the help of thought, you can transform. There are those who can, and that is what science has done, that is what knowledge has done. It's nothing but a series of stories of transformation in the world of matter, in the world of mind, in the world of life. If we live consciously, at every step is the possibility of change. Change is transformation. So if I have that scepter of thought, that is to say, the world of life is controlled by mind. Clarity of a marvelous transforming thought. You have to have an ideal. Then you'd change yourself and become an embodiment of what you believe. Put her magic serpent scepter in thought's grip. Made forms, his inward vision's rhythmic shapes. These are what artists do. They see within them certain shapes. A sculptor has seen a shape, a painter has seen a form, an image. He, in his inner being, he gives it an external expression. That mastery of the inner vision, taking charge of the work that his hand will do. The hand will perform the manifestation of the vision that the inner person has seen. That's what the sculptor has to do. He has to work very hard. Sri Aurobindo very often uses the images of sculpture, because sculpture deals with hard, resistant matter. Stone, often metal. These are all really resistant matter. But these substances can become powerful mediums if the person who is handling the substance is projecting his conscious vision through that. It is something that is really remarkable. If we imagine, say, a statue, for so long, before the statue takes a final shape, the statue exists only in the mind of the sculptor. What we see on the surface is rough stone. Sometimes in the beginning you see bits and pieces that are being cut. You don't know what the final shape will be. But the vision of the sculptor says, just wait. this presence is hidden inside the stone. That stone is going to manifest what is hidden inside it. And sometimes it is so remarkable, because you take certain temples in India, like Ellora, for instance. It is not shaped, it is carved out of the rock. And those who started it were replaced by the next generation. It took 7 generations. And each generation knew what was to be made to emerge. That consciousness was so strong from age to age, from generation to generation, more than 7-8 generations, this stone is gradually lending itself to be shaped. It allows itself to be shaped if the pressure of consciousness is always there. And that is something we have in our country very often. Certain miraculous things happen with stone. It is not shaping a stone, it is breaking down the resistance. Breaking down that which comes in the way of the expression. Slowly. So this is what life can do if it has the guidance of the inner vision. That is why it's like a magic serpent. It has like a wand. It can change. Made forms, his inward vision's rhythmic shapes, and her acts, the living body of his will. Her acts, the acts of life. He is consciousness, she is force. A flaming thunder, a creator flash. His victor light rode on her deathless force. The light rides on her force. So it has to constantly be the collaboration of the coming together of power and knowledge. If one is missing, then there will be no harmony. Very often, one is greater, one is lesser. If there is a lot of force and a less light, there is a sense of violence, the sense of something that is this without harmony. If there is more knowledge, less power, there is also something that is inadequate. He said, the idea is very good, but it is not really expressed in the right way. So, for instance, so many wrote letter poems to, and asked Sri Aurobindo, what do you think of this poem? He said, the theme is good, but it has not... you don't know how to handle your expression sufficiently well. So it is not at all expressive of the truth that you may have experienced yourself. So we need constantly to master the technique, master the force, master the energy, as well as be conscious of ourselves. A centaur's mighty gallop bore the god. The centaur is the half horse, half man. It was in the ancient Greek world where the heroes were trained. The centaur had, he was actually, he had schools. He was the one who was the teacher. He had the head of a man and the body of a horse. So he had the sense of power, but wisdom. In the world of life, wisdom that is emerging out of the body of life, energy. That is really the true living. To be able to live in conscious wisdom. Not to be a slave of desire or passion. And that is why the guide in the ancient schools for the Greek, because these are all mysteries. The Greek mysteries, that means all these mysteries had spiritual significances. The teacher for all these ancient heroes like Theseus and Hercules and all of them were trained by the centaur. A centaur's mighty gallop bore the god. Life throned with mind, a double majesty. Worlds were there for happiness, great and grave. So you have the sense of joy as well. He says only power, only wisdom. What about joy? What about harmony? Of course they were there, he says. But that harmony which has a certain nobility about it, and action tinged with dream, laughter with thought, that is the delight of existence. Sat Chit is there, Ananda has to be there as well. So action has to be tinged with dream, the possibility of a new perfection, the dream has to be realized. When you do something, we have to lead the action to a greater manifestation. For that you have to dream. It is very important to dream. To dream, to move towards something that has not yet been accomplished, not yet been manifested. That has to be tinged with dream. Laughter with thought. There is always that sense of the delight, the divine ananda. All you have to do is to read some of Sri Aurobindo's answers and you will see the constant joy that bubbles out of his letters, the sense of humor that is constantly present in him. Because we have to learn to laugh, not be somber, not only be grave. That is the play. The divine possibilities are so infinitely variable. And he is above them all. And he sees us with all our little deficiencies, big and small, not only little. And the smile that is there on his face, smile of compassion, of sometimes participation, as if he participates in our life. He understands our difficulties. So he action tinged with dream, laughter with thought, and passion there could wait for its desire in this higher world, whereas in our world, passion doesn't wait. It wants what it wants, when it wants to immediately take hold of its desire, satisfy it. But where wisdom is there, knowledge is there, there is also the obedience of the divine law, there is also the sense of patience. So you have the beautiful aspects of the different aspects of life. Life is a principle that has to be. It's the field of manifestation. Without life, there is no execution, no manifestation. It is not by withdrawal from life that one would find the divine ultimate realization. It was such a complicated world that rishis thought, withdraw from life. Get out of this play. It is too complicated. It is too complex. It is in this world of possibilities of that anything can be fulfilled. They have to be taken up. That's why mother's experiment rather. She's put in conditions where all possibilities are offered to us. Physical activities, vital activities, mental activities, provided you do them in the right way, which we do not always do. All the activities that he has put before us become expressions of the spirit, but we do not always do it in the right way. It will take a long time because the lower nature has dominated us for so many millions of centuries, slowly to come out of it and offer this vital force to the service of the divine is the first precondition. So passion there could wait for its desire until it heard the near approach of God to manifest the divine in all things. all activities are put before us. Nothing is forbidden. Through each thing can one feel the divine, can one experience the divine. That is what is the challenge. It is such a difficult thing that we often fail. That doesn't mean it should not be attempted.